This is Radio EcoShock.
We have a fascination for disaster, don't we? It sells in the movies and the news. Fearing the future may be part of our evolutionary brain that got us this far. Matthew Stein doesn't just think about it. He plans, writes, and advises how to survive emergencies and crises of all kinds. With his MIT training in engineering, Matt's built off-grid homes that would probably survive hurricanes. His books include When Disaster Strikes, A Comprehensive Guide for Emergency Planning and Crisis Survival, and his giant reference work, When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. First, we're going to talk about a possible quick planet-wrecking event, and then get to a few tips for surviving a longer period of troubled times. Matt Stein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure being on your show today.
I've enjoyed several of your interviews, and listeners have written in asking to hear you, so I'm glad we finally get a chance to talk. Matt, I've been surfing Google News just a week ago. I saw a brilliant NASA image of a giant solar flare, and it was very beautiful. But in the Huffington Post a while ago, you warned there could be a problem if one of those big solar storms hits the Earth. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's actually a huge problem, and it's guaranteed to happen. And what it is, the sun sort of belches every, fairly often actually. It's like a big bubble of hot, supercharged plasma from the sun goes blasting off into space about 1,000 times faster than our rockets can fly. And most of the time it just flies out harmlessly into space far away from planet Earth. But every now and then we get either a glancing or direct blow. So we've had about 100 significant solar storms in the last 150 years, and we had one about a month ago, and it lit up the sky pretty brilliant. You might have seen some where you live in British Columbia. It lit it up phosphorescent green on Lake Michigan, so it got somewhat south, but it was kind of like a nice light show, but no really big deal. And there was a few flights changed, minor disruption in communications, and that's it. But every now and then, the Earth gets socked by a really huge solar storm called an extreme geomagnetic event. And if that was to happen today, then life as we know it would cease to exist for many people on the planet. And let me explain that. See, the last time a really huge geomagnetic storm struck our planet was in 1921, and it was a two-day-long event, and it lit up the skies, brilliant colors, from the North Pole all the way south to Haiti and Hawaii, and from the South Pole all the way as far north as Samoa. So the entire planet, except for a narrow sliver in the deep tropical zones, was lit up at nighttime for two nights. Now, when the last geomagnetic extreme event hit, it was not a big deal for the planet. I mean, there was no big electric grid. There were no nuclear power plants. There was no internet in those days. And so when it struck, it caused some electrical havoc in some cities. It burned down Penn Central Station from induced currents. And the time before that one struck was 1859, an even bigger storm hit. It was a week-long global light show event. And in 1859, when it hit, it actually burned down a few telegraph stations. It set some telegraph lines and poles on fire. And again, the world kind of went around like normal. Well, fast forward to today. Today we have, in the United States alone, we have 100,000 miles of extra high voltage power lines that interconnect our grid. Those things didn't exist in 1921. There was just individual electrified cities, and most of the countryside was totally unelectrified, and there was no interconnecting grid. So today, if that storm from 1921 hit, you'd have 100,000 miles of power lines acting like a giant antenna. And when that geomagnetic storm hits, they would be sucking up an incredible pulse of energy that had been started from that mass ejection coming out of the sun. Now, what does that do? Well, it runs down those power lines, and at the ends of each of these power lines is something called an extra high voltage transformer. These are like 350,000 volts up to a million volt transformers. And when it hits those, they burn up. And when they burn up, then our grid stops working. Now, people say, well, okay, big deal. So you burn a few transformers, you can go down to the hardware supply, buy another transformer, right? It's like, no, these are custom-made transformers. They're like 25 feet tall. They're 300 tons each. They're tens of millions of dollars each. They have to shut down a freeway when they deliver one of these giant transformers. And, I mean, this is a huge deal. What you're talking about is in a two-day storm like 1921, you're talking about burning a third of these transformers in North America. That's 350 of them. Now, we built this transformer system, and we put these big transformers in over three decades, from 1970s, 80s, and 90s, to pretty much replace and revamp the American power grid. And you're talking in 2 hours cooking most of those. Now, how long are we down for? Well, if we blow 350 in North America, 2,000 worldwide, that's about 10 to 20 years worth of production at maximum capacity when the world's still working well. So we're looking at a situation where the power's down over not all of North America, but most of the populated and densely populated areas for months to years. Now, what does that mean? Well, 3 days of food supply in our major cities. Used to be three decades ago, they had a month's worth of food in warehouses at every major city. But now everything's coordinated by the Internet. It's all just-in-time deliveries. So the food you're going to eat on Monday is still on a truck on Thursday getting ready to be delivered somewhere in the city. So when the grid goes down, then all of a sudden there's no oil being refined. There's no water being pumped. There's no water being purified. There's no sewage being pumped. There's no elevators running. There's no air conditioners running. There's no television, TV, no Internet. Washington, D.C. is shut down. The stock market collapses. The military can't function without the grid. See, we have a world that's totally dependent on the grid. But now, there's an even bigger problem. And that's why my article is titled 400 Chernobyls, and I'll explain that. See, every nuclear power plant in the world, right now as it's configured today, they're designed so that when the grid goes down or has a severe anomaly, they automatically go into emergency shutdown mode. See, they can't operate without being hooked into the grid. So when the grid goes down, they start shutting themselves down. And it's not like flipping a switch on your light, and all of a sudden you flip the switch and all the lights go out in your house. This is a different situation. When a nuclear power plant shuts down, it starts slowing the reaction down. It doesn't stop it like a flip of a switch. So you have a huge amount of heat that's normally boiling millions of gallons of water to create steam to run giant turbines that can power an entire city off a single nuclear power plant. Now, all of a sudden, all that heat has to go somewhere. So what they do is they have cooling system pumps that keep cooling and running the water through the cores and run them up to towers to cool them. Well, when Fukushima failed, according to the Japanese authorities, it wasn't the earthquake directly that caused those power plants, those nuclear reactors, to melt down. What happened is the earthquake took down the grid. So what do the power plants do? Well, they automatically go into emergency shutdown mode. So immediately, backup generators and battery packs kick in, start driving the pumps to keep those reactors cooling so that they don't burn themselves up. Well, 20 minutes later, the tsunami comes along, wipes out the backup batteries and the backup generators, and the pumps stop working, and the cores on those reactors start overheating. And in between 15 minutes and a few hours later, they've critically overheated and failed. And then what happened is you got super hot nuclear reactor cores, and they're in contact with water, and they start dissociating the water into hydrogen and oxygen. Well, these reactors are designed supposedly to have really thick containment vessels, like 6-foot-thick walls of concrete and steel, to try and keep all that stuff inside in case there's a problem with the reactor. Well, when the water hit those super hot cores and made hydrogen and oxygen gas, the gases floated up to the top of the reactor containment vessel, and they recombined and exploded and blew the vessels. So not only did you have reactor cores that had melted down critically and permanently destroyed the reactor, you've now blown the containment vessel and they're leaking.
You could see this happening right around the world if we had one of these solar storm events. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So what happens in the world now? You've got a weak supply of fuel mandated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at each and every one of these reactors. You've got 104 of them in America. 37% of all Americans live within 50 miles of a nuclear reactor because they build these things not right in the city but close to the cities because they don't want to, you know, they want to generate the power near where they're going to use it so they don't lose a lot of power and transmission losses. So a week later, after one of these giant solar storms has knocked the grid out in most of the densely populated parts of the country and, in fact, parts of the industrial world, these power plants are going to start running out of fuel. Now, some people called me up and said, Mr. Stein, you know, I work in a nuclear power plant, and we've got a month's worth of food. Okay, so you got a month's worth of food. Well, the Congressional Bipartisan Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, EMP Commission, determined that it was probably going to be 4 to 10 years before we really get the grid rolling well again after an event like this. And that was verified in an independent study by the National Academy of Sciences. So we're looking at not days, not weeks, but in the best case, we're looking at months, and in the worst case, many years before things get up to speed again. So I just can't imagine if you had a situation where it's equal to like 100 Hurricane Katrinas going off in America all at once, and there's riots in the street, and people aren't, there's no food, and there's no communication, there's no power, there's no heat. I just can't imagine that diesel fuel trucks are going to show up like clockwork, like the government officials have promised, at each and every one of our 104 nuclear power plants in this country to make sure that when they run out of backup fuel, that they've got a fresh supply of fuel on hand to keep them running. So we're looking at a situation that's horrible without the nuclear part. And when you add in the nuclear part to the equation, you're looking at an end of the world as we know it and possibly the extinction of human beings and mammalian life. Now, there's a good news, bad news side to the story. The good news is, for $1 billion, half the price of a B-2 stealth bomber, half the price of one of those single bombers, we could implement new technology that's just been developed and it's been proven in EMP simulation chambers to work. It's new vacuum tube-based technology. You think, well, vacuum tubes, that's old technology. Well, no, these are like giant special vacuum tubes. They found solid-state devices just weren't fast enough and robust enough to do the job. So they've developed technology that can protect each of these giant transformers from the massive surge coming down the line from either an electromagnetic pulse from a nuclear detonation from some rogue state or terrorist group or from a super solar storm. So for only $1 billion, which is pretty small change in the scope of things when you compare the bank bailout, we could prevent the end of the world as we know it. And for another $1 billion or so, we could mandate that there's a year's worth of fuel on hand at each and every nuclear installation, that there's backup generators and backup critical components for the control systems that are stored in EMP-hardened containers at each and every one of these nuclear power plants. So for $2 billion, the price of a stealth bomber, and a tiny fraction of the price of the TARP bank bailout, we could prevent the end of the world as we know it. Now, we can't prevent every bad thing from happening, from an electromagnetic pulse attack from a terrorist or from a solar storm from the sun, an extreme solar storm, but we can prevent the end of the world as we know it. We can prevent the collapse of society, the collapse of the stock market, the collapse of the government, the collapse of everything that keeps our world of 7 billion people running and fed and, you know, working reasonably well. We can prevent that from going away in a poof.
Well, you know, Matt, it's just sort of a sign of our almost suicidal mentality that we just haven't gone ahead and spent that money right away. And I have to say, too, that, you know, we've got to do it around the world. What we found with Fukushima is a reactor can blow on the other side of the world and the whole northern hemisphere gets irradiated. So it has to go in wherever there are nuclear plants. And frankly, I think we should shut down the nuclear plants because we're not on top of this technology. But we do need to move on. So this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with disaster expert Matthew Stein about events that happened in the past and will happen again. We just can't say when. We started with a low probability, super high risk event we call a solar storm, which could cause nuclear reactors around the world to melt down. Find a link to Matt's article, 400 Chernobyls, Solar Flares, EMP, and Nuclear Armageddon, in my blog at ecoshock.info or at Matt's blog at whentechfails.com. Now, Matt, I'd like to move on to another projected event with no fixed date. We've spoken to several guests who expect just-in-time shipping methods will feed us all, but they could stop on short notice for a number of reasons. As you pointed out, it could be a war, could be a new virus, or a sudden economic breakdown like the one that almost happened in 2008. So let's assume we don't fall into violent anarchy if the industrial system hiccups and our better intentions come out and we want to survive as communities. Before we get to some solutions, which you do offer, Matt, what are the early challenges we face when technology fails like that?
Well, you know, everybody, I believe, should have what's called a 72-hour grab-and-run kit. And if you go to whentechfails.com and click on articles, you'll see a lot of great, totally free information, including a bunch of recommended items, about 25 or 30 items in that. And what the grab and run kit, or some people call it bug out bags, survival kits, it basically provides for you and your family the critical things you need in the first few days of a crisis. So it provides for fresh drinking water, the ability to purify water. Provides food, shelter, clothing, first aid, basic medicines, whatever you might need to get by for a few days. I mean, we've seen in all kinds of crises that, you know, if it's a big crisis like the Kobe, Japan quake or Hurricane Katrina, that the authorities are just totally overloaded, and to count on somebody coming in to do it for you is just plain wishful thinking. So that's kind of like the first thing. Then the next step is to look at local self-resilience. You know, what is it that we can do so that if the global economy is not working, if the world shipping is shut down, if Pakistan and India threw nukes at each other, or, you know, the spent fuel ponds go up in Japan and it's thrown a wrench into the entire world's machine that makes the world go round, how can you deal with things in a longer term? And in that, you're starting to look at things like trade and barter. You're looking at things like, can you grow food? Can you forage for food? For instance, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there's sort of two countries that are often talked about as an example of, you know, how can we deal with the peak in world oil production, and what would happen if the global machine stopped? And those two countries are Cuba and North Korea. See, when both of those countries depended on the Soviet Union for their supply line, for spare parts, for automobiles, for, you know, air conditioners, for oil, for coal, you know, the kinds of things that supported technological society. It's like, you know, they weren't tied into America in any way, shape, or form, so they looked to the Soviets for that. So when the Soviet Union collapsed in the mid-1990s, then all of a sudden their pipeline got shut off. Well, the two countries are the two examples of one doing it right, meaning Cuba, and two doing it wrong, meaning North Korea. So if you lived in North Korea and you weren't part of the government, then you were totally on your own. You had no electricity. You had no access to food. You probably didn't have potable water. You know, you're kind of scrapping along for yourself. So the people who made it through that were good at foraging, were good at black market and trade and barter. All of the rats and mice got eaten quite quickly, cockroaches, grasshoppers, all of that stuff. If you weren't good at combing the mountainside for edible plants and foods and roots, then you probably starved, unless you had a pipeline into the government for supplies. Now, in Cuba, it was a sort of an opposite story. In Cuba, it was like, okay, how can we work together to solve this problem? What's the power of community in Cuba? Now, granted, they had a more benign climate, so that was in their favor. But essentially, they switched over to draft animals and old-fashioned organic farming methods and old-fashioned tools. And they went, you know, meat consumption went way down. The average Cuban lost about 25 or 30 pounds of weight, but they were actually probably healthier. They switched over from pharmaceutical medicines to homeopathy and herbal-based medicines. And, you know, the country did really quite well. I mean, nobody died of starvation, or very few, and life went on, and, you know, there was disruptions, but they worked together and made it all work out.
Huh. Well, you know, Matt, in an emergency, some people go into non-responsive shock. We saw it in New Orleans after Katrina and Asia after the tsunamis, in towns that are blown away by hurricanes or storms. But other folks come alive in an emergency. They go into some kind of overdrive to organize for survival. And I'm wondering, does that come from thinking about these things in advance, or do you think it's social or genetic differences that freeze some folks while empowering others? What are your thoughts?
Yes. all of the above. Certainly, being prepared ahead of time, my big book, When Technology Fails, goes into the whole thing of self-reliance and sustainability. So about half of the book is about emergency preparedness, food storage, survival, alternative healing, first aid. Those kinds of skills are quite helpful in a situation. And the other half of the book, well, it's kind of a third, a third in the survival preparedness, about a third on sustainability and self-reliance, and then about a third is sort of old-fashioned technologies, because in the days of our grandparents, or in some people's great-great-grandparents, someone in every small town in America knew how to grow, fabricate, or make whatever was needed for a reasonable standard of living and survival. And so there's power in community, because no one person can know and do it all. And in a community like that, someone could blow glass, someone could do pottery, someone could weave cloth, someone could tan leather, someone could make that leather into leather goods and saddles, things like that. But those skills have been, for the most part, lost in our modern day, where everything's built in factories, mostly in foreign countries thousands of miles away from here. So the last third of When Technology Fails is kind of like teaching the rudiments of all of those skills that people knew a couple hundred years ago. Someone in the town knew, not everybody, but somebody knew them. And those things could be very valuable again. Now, in a crisis, it usually brings out the best in people. The media tends to focus on the worst and the thug action and, the raping and pillaging part. And that does happen, but usually it brings out the best in people and they pull together. And certainly, having thought about it, having prepared yourself mentally and physically, and having learned some skills, those are all wonderful things to do, and they'll only help you in a situation like that. But there are some people who, in spite of their preparations, just fall to pieces, and there are other people who aren't prepared, but something inside of them kicks in, and they step up to the plate, and they, it brings out strengths that they perhaps before hadn't known they had. So there are no general rules. They're just guidelines.
I think that's a good reason why people should go to an Occupy meeting, because there you're looking at a situation where there is no authority, and that's exactly what could happen. And you're looking at how groups of people who don't know each other too well, maybe at the start, learn to communicate with one another and get some action going and get the basic things. Some of those Occupy camps, they worked out the water, the food, the sewage, the communications, the entertainment, self-education, all of that happened pretty quickly. And I think that's a good example. So I'm encouraging listeners, if you have some more Occupy things happening, get out there and have a look. I wanted to move on to James Howard Kunstler. He's written about when oil supplies run out, a couple of novels, and he calls it the long emergency, which you've adopted in your book as well. How do your ideas work into that scenario of a long, slow descent?
Well, I don't see any way out of that at this point in time without some kind of magical new technology sort of to bail us out. Now, I've written an article called The Perfect Storm, Six Trends Converging on Collapse. And so far, we've managed to slow probably one of the six trends down somewhat, but we haven't really done anything with the other five. And the only one we've slowed down, and we certainly haven't stopped, is population growth. So I think the long emergency, we're either going to go off a cliff with some cataclysmic event or series of events, or we're going to be headed for the long emergency. And I think if you accept that that's the case, then you can see the chance for transformation in there. And I think the Occupy movement's a wonderful example in the Arab Spring of like inklings of this change are in the wind. Because it's quite clear to me that continuing the current trends, the way our world got where it is right now, will guarantee collapse. And I'm hoping that as proactive human beings with brains in our heads, that we can actually wake up and change the course of where we're headed. Now, unfortunately, the people who are at the top and the corporations at the top got there through the old model, and so they have a huge stake in keeping the old model going. So it's kind of one of these things of, do we get shaken up badly enough to make major changes, or do we just allow momentum and business as usual to take us over the cliff? So the sort of better scenario is it's a long, slow emergency where it gives us time to adapt and time to sort of get ready and prepare and shift the way we do things and what we accept in our life, as that this is the general trend we're headed in. Unfortunately, the way exponential growth tends to work is and all the models of limits to growth done at MIT in the 1970s indicate that without proactive intervention, it's probably going to be more like a fairly rapid fall off of a cliff or a very steep downslope rather than a long, slow emergency.
So, Matt, I've got to ask you on a personal level, why do you focus on such negative futures?
Well, I call myself the optimistic doomer. So the last chapter in When Technology Fails is called Making the Shift to Sustainability. And I have a new book I'd like to get out called Making Shift Happen, Changing Course from Collapse to Renaissance. So I believe that if we're going to have a positive future, then we have to first acknowledge rather than deny the truth of where our trends are going and look at them quite realistically. Because so long as we kind of deny that they're headed for that cliff or that train wreck, then we're really not going to do the significant changes we need to make in order to avoid the train wreck or avoid the going off the cliff.
Our guest, Matthew Stein, has worked for renewable energy, sustainable growth, and alternative healing techniques. You can find his websites at mattstein.com, stein-design.com, and www.whentechfails.com. If you really want to know what to do if the lights go out, make sure you have a copy of Matt's latest encyclopedic work called When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. And I recommend the paper version of that in case the internet isn't working. We may not be able to Google the next solution. Matt, we've got to have you back to get more tips out of you. I'm sorry we're out of time now. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Alex, and have a great day. I like to leave people with my motto, and I ask people to do their best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. Thank you so much for having me on today.
We'll do that. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.